In the days of the Anglo-Saxons, English was the word on the street. Well, I guess actually the horse path. It was the talk between friends. It was the curses hurled at our enemies. But it was not so much the language associated with status, with God, or with learning. That honor belonged with the Romance languages. First Latin, and later French. Predating English, Latin had arrived with the Roman legionaries that occupied what they referred to as Britannia until the 5th century. And despite the crumbling of the Roman Empire, the legacy of Latin in the British Isles was far from over. A couple of centuries later, following the conversion to Christianity of the newly settled Germanic tribes whose tongues would end up as English's founding dialects, Latin rose up again as the language of education and of religion. Important transactions were recorded not in English, but in Latin. As a result, grammar rules were not high on the list of what Old English movers and shakers were worried about, at least not the rules of English. Latin, a classical language, had both a scholarly tradition and an elitist cachet that English at that time lacked, and it meant English was free to develop, unhindered by ideas about how it should be. This view of English as not worthy of much literary or grammatical study was even more pronounced with the onset of the Middle English period and the invasion of the French-speaking Normans in 1066. For hundreds of years, Britain was ruled by people who did not speak the language of the common man or woman. English, a tongue considered vulgar and low class by the new social elite. It might get you a position in the kitchen, but certainly not in court or in government, where documents were written in Anglo-Norman French or in Latin. By not being the language of the elite, English was not constrained by top-down regulation, though it was still subject to substantial linguistic and social pressure from French. In fact, Sir Walter Scott's classic Ivanhoe nicely characterizes politics and language in post-Norman England and provides insight into how this inequitable relationship between the Anglo-Saxons and the French led to the dichotomous animal, Saxon versus food, Norman, names still in play today, such as pig pork and cow beef. Similarly, from this pressure from French, English shed much of its Germanic word stock and changed up its sound system and morphology, combining Old English roots with Old French suffixes like ants, as in hindrance. It took on loads of new words from French and Latin, gained several new sounds, welcome V and Z, and said au revoir to many of its Old English endings. Goodbye, N. Have you ever wondered why we say oxen instead of oxes, actually? You can thank our German roots for that in the form of the Old English A-N-E-N plural suffix that coexisted with an S plural ending. By the 14th century, S had pretty much become the only way to pluralize, and E-N was maintained in fewer and fewer word forms, like children and oxen. While this shift is not directly attributed to the influence of the French, S was adopted early by Anglo-Normans, likely helping usher this leveling along. It's a good thing the French also brought us fashion, medicine, art, and music, as in literally brought us these words, so we can forgive this intrusion into our language. In this melding of the speech of the common and the powerful, the foundation of the English we hold so dear today was laid. Notably, not from linguistic stasis or prescription, but from nothing short of dynamic linguistic and social upheaval. But before English could fully ascend, it had to throw off the shackles of Norman French. And it is through this rise in prominence starting around the 15th century that English began to take on shackles of a different sort, that of standardization and prescription. The transition to English as the language of power, education, and high society was greatly helped along by the increasing urbanization and cultural prominence of London in the early modern period. London's East Midland dialect became the fashionable dialect of those hobnobbing with the royals, those doing the work of government administration at the Chancery Court, as well as the better brought-up sort for whom the city was home. Toss in William Caxton's introduction of the printing press in 1476, leading to the adoption of the London dialect as the literary standard, and you have a perfect prescriptivist storm in the making. Still, it really took until the 18th century, with the increasing publication of dictionaries and usage guides, and the focus on language purification, for the guardians of culture to start caring about enshrining English as it should be, With new rules came more opportunities for linguistic rebellion, and evolving speech habits became the enemy.